In this podcast, you may hear topics about suicide, mental health, other kinds of emotional crisis. If you find yourself being startled by this or currently experiencing something like is being talked about, especially suicide, I want to encourage you to reach out. The number 988 is a suicide crisis hotline, or you can reach out to myself also. But know that you are loved and take care.
Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad
when I see. Welcome to Faith of Appalachia, Hidden Stories of Faith and Value, a podcast where we're going to explore personal stories, particularly spirituality in a culture where everyone thinks everyone's exactly the same. But we believe that as we look at personal stories, we're going to dive in and hear deeply of how people are exploring truth and things that are most important to them, and maybe in some surprising ways. And I'm really excited about our guest today. I've known Brother Christian now for a while. I don't even know how long now, but have been really moved by your real love for truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a real, I mean, like, I think in our day and age, there really isn't an exploration for truth, but I'm reminded of what the Dalai Lama had said. You know, if you explore truth and it takes you to a place you didn't think so, maybe you need to adjust your place. Mm. And you are exploring truth inside the boundaries of faith, but also being willing to say, like, as we go, we just want the truth, right? We want the truth. And you will have the coolest, outfit, uniform in Pikeville. Clear. I thought with a collar, like, everyone would come up and talk to me. No one talks to me, but everyone wants to comment on what you're wearing. So
sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad.
That's exactly right. So we are very thankful to our grant sponsor, the National Endowment for Humanities, Kentucky Humanities. I'm Rob Music. I'm a priest and chaplain. Today, we've already gotten started, but Brother Christian, here you are. You're in the flesh. You're in the person. So tell us about you.
Well, I'm a monk of the Catholic Diocese of Lexington. I'm technically what's called a diocesan hermit. So for me, that means I'm a solitary monk. Not all hermits are monks, but I was formed in the Benedictine monastic tradition. So I consider myself still in that tradition. So I live in a hermitage here in Pikeville. This is my habit, and the white speaks to our resurrection hope, our Easter hope as Christians. And I am here basically to pray for the people of Eastern Kentucky, and to serve them in whatever way I can.
A monk in Pikeville, Kentucky. That's mind-blowing.
I'm the only Catholic monk in Eastern Kentucky.
Okay, so there you go. Make sure people know that there were not like a hotbed of monks. No. And you are a solitary monk, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you're not like a bunch of other monks hanging out in your place or anything like that?
No, no.
And then you said you have a, you didn't say a monastery, you said you have a hermitage. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, tell me a little bit more about what that means.
It basically means I have a house where I live with me and my dog and the Blessed Sacrament. So I have a chapel with permission of the bishop. I have the Blessed Sacrament in a chapel in my home. So that's where I pray. You know, that's where I like to go to sit and be with God and read and spend some time in silence. And I do most of my work from home. But, you know, I occasionally have people come over to visit. You know, sometimes I have people stay in my guest room for hospitality. Dorothy Day said every house should have a Christ room for Christ.
That's cool.
Present as a guest.
Christ room, yeah.
Yeah. And I just try and make it a space where I can be still and encounter God and then take into that space my encounters with other people and, you know, their needs and my prayers for them. And then let the time spent praying in that space bear fruit in work and service back to my community. So it's a dialogue, like breathing in and out, in and out.
Yeah, you know, I think many times when people think about monks, they think of people who are really separate and maybe not involved in the community at all. And here you are, you know, highly involved in the community, but as a contemplative, also being informed by that.
And there's a spectrum, right? So
okay. There's
people who are completely reclusive, mm-hmm. And that's their call, like to go completely out in the desert or in the mountains and not interact. They may, you know, just go to church on Sundays, or they may not even go to church at all, or very rarely, you know, just at Easter or Christmas or something. Mm-hmm. But they're there just to be completely separate and silent and pray for the world in their in their hermitage. The Carthusians are monks like that. They don't leave their monastery. They don't really engage the wide world at all.
Wow.
You know, like the superior will know what major news is going on in the world. So if World War II breaks out, you know, they would pray for, you know.
But
not the monks as a whole won't get any more news until the war is over. War is over. Congratulations, you know, sing the Te Deum. So there are people who are called to that complete separation to pray for the needs of the world.
Yeah.
And then there's folks who are known as, you know, active apostolic religious, whose job is to get right down in the middle of the dirt and the muck, side by side with everybody else, and work in the trenches.
Mm.
And then there's everywhere in between. So the monastic life tends to be more on the reclusive, contemplative end, separation end, which is why I live by myself and spend most of my time in my hermitage. But I'm, in terms of hermits, I'm definitely on the active and engaged end of the spectrum.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't want to, you know, let it, you know, make it seem like I'm typical. I'm definitely on one end of the spectrum of the hermit life.
Okay.
But yeah, just because you're a hermit doesn't mean that you don't care about the needs of your community and the church. And also there's rhythms for different times in life. So, you know, sometimes my rhythm has me more quiet and separate, and sometimes my rhythm has me more active and engaged, as it is right now, due to the needs of the world in our current time.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, the hope is to be able to go back and spend some more time in quiet and, you know, and just kind of let prayer and discernment and the spirit, you know, suggest where I am in that rhythm and where what I need to be doing. And also, you know, engage in regular spiritual direction, discussion mm-hmm. with my superior, who's the bishop.
Okay.
To make sure I'm on track. You know, if they say, hey, you're kind of doing a little too much, you want to pull back, or, you know, you feel like you really need to speak up on this, go ahead.
Okay.
You know, so I try and test that with others.
So it's through the authority of the bishop. So
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And then, you know, you mentioned about kind of your call and how you interpret the times and all that. Like, how do you, here we are in April of 2025, as a religious person who's deeply committed to listening to God, how do you describe right now?
These times are unprecedented in my lifetime. Of course, I'm only 40.
All the times.
Yeah, exactly. you know. But I just don't see how one can be a Christian right now and not stand up against what is being said in the church and what is being said in our country that is against the gospel. Now, again, there are people whose specific calls are to pray and offer all that to God in intercessory prayer, and that's their form of engagement. I feel like I'm being asked to engage with, in a more public way, with the community to say these laws, these rules are not right, and somebody has to step up and say, you can't do this anymore. And there are lay people all over the country, all over the world, who are stepping up and for freedom, for the gospel, for love for one's neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
We just had the Feast of Oscar Romero,
mm-hmm.
and we just had the anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And these were church leaders who were definitely criticized for being political.
Mm-hmm.
But as my bishop, John Stowe, has said, the church must be political. You know, it's not partisan.
Yeah.
But that when you see evil being done and lies being spoken as truth, you have to say that's a lie. You have to call out the lie and live by the truth, and give other people courage to live by the truth by the fact that you're doing that.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful. I mean, the idea that, you know, you're not partisan. It's not like we're all Democrats, we're all Republicans or whatever, but there's a gospel issue, a truth issue, and unless we stand up and speak, we're not going to be giving space and courage to others.
Yeah.
Right? The average lay person is not going to feel emboldened if everybody who's wearing any kind of religious attire is being completely quiet.
Well, and honestly, right now it's the lay people who are leading the charge.
Okay.
You know,
wow.
And if we're not going to step up and back them up, what are we good for? You know, what witness do we give if we say, man, you know, I can stay safe in my monastery and not do anything? Now, again, there are people who are in their monasteries who are doing things there that are more hidden, that are equally as valuable, but they're still supporting, they're still praying, they're still forming others. You know, monastery where I did my formation runs a school. And so the way they contribute primarily is by inculcating moral values and critical thinking in young people.
okay.
You know, as they're being formed, to go out and then live the gospel in their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, but we do need to have religious leaders who step in, like Bishop Mark Seitz in the Catholic tradition, who's the Bishop of El Paso.
Okay.
You know, he just led a march to support immigrants in El Paso a couple weeks ago that my bishop was at.
Oh.
You know, we need to have church leaders who are stepping up and saying, you're right, lay folks who are leading the charge, leading these marches, you're absolutely right in the gospel. You're on the side of the gospel. We have to welcome the stranger. We have to speak for the truth. Because people look at religious, at clergy, mm-hmm. You know, I'm not clergy, I'm religious, but I'm not clergy in the Catholic tradition, but you're a clergy, mm-hmm. You know, look at people who are, you know, dressed like we're dressed, mm-hmm. you know, saying that we represent the church.
Yeah.
And if we're not in the trenches alongside them, at least some of us, you know, backing them up and also going further than we can, because, you know, in your tradition, clergy can married and you have a family.
Yeah.
And my church, well, for religious, you know, we're not married. I don't have a family that relies on me for income. I have more freedom.
Yes, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To take more risks mm-hmm. than somebody who has to, you know, think of their family's safety, which, again, doesn't stop lots of lay people who
right.
have those conversations with their You're families right. about what does our family believe. You know, we're willing to take risks.
Well, that's so interesting you say that. I had never really thought about that. You know, we think in higher ed, like, you know, people with tenure are given that, that really to people to do some maybe cutting edge stuff, or because you've got that safety of, yeah. of tenure. And then here you are talking about the, you know, religious life, and because you are single, that by its very nature is supposed to design you to be able to take more. I had never really yeah. thought about the idea of, like, you know, prepare or making space for risk. You know, yeah. I was just thinking, wow, you could be working 24/7 now.
Which not, Jesus didn't do.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which I have to remind myself,
yes,
you know.
There is that Sabbath piece. so growing up, I suspect that you did not, you know, when you were six, say, I'm going to be a socially active, you know, hermit monk in Eastern Kentucky, right? So maybe you did.
Well, I wanted to be a warrior monk, or like I wanted to. I mean, I loved like stories about, you know, knights in armor,
oh,
you know, going
okay.
around. When I read Don Quixote in high school, I thought that was not crazy.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's cool.
My kind of vision growing up in my life was I wanted to like ride my horse around the country doing good for people. And so when I became Catholic, I was like, oh, that's basically a Jesuit.
yeah, I
which,
mean, really.
which was the religious order through which I came into the church.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I my first encounter with the Catholic environment, because I grew up Presbyterian Church USA, mm-hmm. my first time in Catholic environment was at Loyola University, Maryland, where I was in grad school. And I met the Jesuits, and Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, talks. He had been a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Loved stories of chivalry, you know, talked about being a knight for Christ. And I went, that's what I want to be, you know? That knight for Christ language, I grew up with Lord of the Rings, I grew up with King Arthur, I always wanted to be a knight for Christ.
Oh.
So when I met the Jesuits, I was like, this is what I've been looking for my entire life. Now then the Jesuits said no. So after 10 years of looking for another order, you know, I finally found a bishop who was willing to welcome me as a monk in his diocese. But it was always, I always wanted to, even though I thought monks died out in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
But I always wanted to merge that contemplative root and that contemplative stance of the monk with the active engagement of the warrior, of the knight.
Mm.
So this, in a way, even though the exact details, like I had really no connection to Kentucky.
Yeah. Okay.
Although I found out my grandmother actually went to teaching college at UK.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
About that. I didn't know that. Okay.
Neither did I. so there's a connection to Kentucky. You know, I always wanted to live a kind of life that had both those elements, you know, which is another reason why I love the Jesuits. They have that phrase, contemplatives in action.
Mm-hmm.
What is both challenging and also, I think, good about the monastic tradition is there's a vow of stability in the Benedictine tradition to stay rooted in one place. And being now in Eastern Kentucky for almost 3 years, the importance of place,
mm.
I'm stability and rootedness in place is a core value of Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah, right. Okay, it makes sense. Yeah, Appalachian value. Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, in New York City, where I also lived for several years, one of the core values is kind of flexibility and moving around and going where the work is and going where creativity is and being rootless, being peripatetic, being able to go wherever, which is also a core value of Jesuits. You know, our cloister is the road. Mm. You know, we go where we're sent, when we're sent. But one of the benefits of Benedictines over the centuries has been they commit to a place and they build something in that place and they slowly transform the place by their life of contemplation, prayer, agriculture, you know, being a root for the community. I don't know, you've probably seen that movie Of Gods and Men.
Oh, yeah.
About the Algerian monks. Yeah. I'm named after Christian, the prior. Yeah.
I don't know that. Okay.
That's where my religious name is from. And, you know, they formed their monastery in this little village, and the Muslim village grew up around them. Mm. And actually, you don't see this in the film, but in real life, that village did not have a mosque, so the monks let the villagers use part of the monastery complex as their mosque.
Beautiful, wow.
And there's a line in the film where the monks are trying to decide, do we leave because, you know, the terrorists are going after foreigners and we're all French. And a lady in the village says, you know, you're the branch, we're the birds. If you leave, you know, we're lost. You know, you've basically been the heart around this village that has grown around. And there's so many people in so many places here in Eastern Kentucky, you know, where families and institutions have become rooted and, you know, have grown up communities over generations around those places. And I'm very much a guest in this place. Mm. But one of the things that the people of Eastern Kentucky witnessed to me is that Benedictine value and challenged me on that of committing to a place and caring for it and building community and growing family and cultivating that place and making it grow and flourish so it can be a welcoming home for others. And that seems to me very much to be a Benedictine value that's core to Eastern Kentucky.
Wow, so it really seems like the spiritual tradition and the place are really aligning in kind of a beautiful way for you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you want to be a warrior for Christ, and, you know, you're off in grad school, and you make this connection, and you said a 10-year journey. You know, I think that sometimes, at least in my own mind, you think, okay, I'm going to say yes to Jesus, I'm going to do this thing, and then, like, tomorrow, it's going to, like, the doors are going to open up, and it's going to happen, and we don't typically think about 10-year process and like all this kind of stuff. So your spiritual journey has really taken you in various places. And how do you describe that spiritual journey?
It was very difficult. I don't know if you've ever seen the Shrek musical.
Oh, no.
You expected me to bring up the Shrek musical, right?
Yeah, of course. That's logical.
Which, by the way, so we're talking about... It's now April 2025. They're doing the Shrek musical at the Appalachian Center for the Arts this summer. So if you haven't seen it, you can go see it.
Shameless plug.
Exactly. But there is a great song in there called, I think it's called Storybook. And it's Fiona, who's the ogress who's waiting for her prince, you know, shortly after she becomes an ogre. She reads all these storybooks of other storybook princesses and how their prince comes. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, I know it's today. I know he's going to come. You know, day 23, and then she realizes in all these stories, she waits for years and years and years, and then he comes. And, you know, she waits for decades, and then he comes, and she's, oh no. You know, and then the song goes, you know, it's day 823, it's day 8,423, and every day she's gone, what's going to happen today? My dream's going to come true today.
Mm.
And it's the waiting. We spend a bulk of our time in the waiting.
Yeah,
wow. And we're coming up to, you know, Holy Week, and you know, Holy Saturday is a day which every day for us Christians it's Good Friday, it's Easter Sunday, but it's also Holy Saturday.
Mm.
You know, Christ has come, and he will come again, and we're in that waiting for the fulfillment of the promise of the resurrection in all of creation. And so for me, I thought, this has got to be easy. I think I'm a good person. People tell me they enjoy talking to me. You know, I had several you know, spiritual directors and mentors who said, you're a great fit for religious life. You know, any order would be happy to have you.
Okay.
And then to have order after order for 10 years say, we think you're a great candidate, but because of your medical history, we just can't consider you. You know, and that being that, you know, I was identified as female at birth and had a male gender identity my entire life, didn't know what was going on until college when I learned about the diagnosis, which was at the time called gender identity disorder, now called gender dysphoria. But that there's, you know, evidence that for some people, their brain is either masculinized or feminized in a way that's opposite from the rest of their body. So we know that the sexual differentiation of the brain can diverge from the other markers of sex. And so for me, basically, I have a male brain, you know, which doesn't match, you know, the other markers that were identified at birth. And there's a treatment for that. There's, you know, medical transition treatment you can do. And so once I realized that this was a medical condition I can solve, I did the medical treatment and I switched to living as male. And I've lived my entire adult life as a man. But that was difficult for the religious orders I was talking to because they really didn't know what to do with me. And it was just a difficult problem. And they basically, you know, I got lots of, it's not you, it's us. You know, we're just not ready to incorporate someone with such a complicated history into our community. And so, you know, that really hurt for quite a while because I would have friends ask me, so have you thought about, you know, becoming a priest, or have you thought about joining this order? Would you like to join my order? And I would say, I'd love to join your order, but you might not know this. Your order has said no to me 5 times, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And so having a group of guys where you felt like these are my people and the members are saying, you're one of us, but then the superiors are saying, well, you might be the same kind of guys that we are, but some rule above us says that we can't consider you, or just even refuse to talk to me because it was considered too dangerous to even consider even talking to me.
So even the conversation is too dangerous.
Yeah, there was one person who said that just the conversation about my situation was itself harmful to the church, and that what was best for the church was basically for me to disappear. Is basically, this person's existence is so threatening, we need to pretend like they don't even exist.
I mean, I just, that takes my breath away.
Yeah.
Here I am in the third party here. You know, we started out when we talked about how you're, you know, you're exploring the truth and going after it.
Yeah.
And so you discover this medical situation, right? And you're like, oh, wait, there's an alleviation for this. So you do all the, you know, what you need to do medically. And then the place where you're searching for truth the most inside the church, for the church to say, yeah, no, like that experience doesn't work, that, you know, that framework doesn't work.
Or not even, we've thought about it and we've decided it doesn't work, it's we don't even want to think about it.
Oh, okay, so thank you, thanks for framing it that way. Yeah, it's like, we're not even going to even have this conversation, meet this person, listen to them, blah, blah, blah. So, of course, this is a question you probably get 3,000 times a day. It begs the question, you know, why on earth did you stay? If you felt like you'd had the truth in your own personal life, why stay in an organization that says we won't even have the conversation?
Because I love the church. It's my family. Mm. And because I love the church and care for the church, I want the church to feel that freedom to discuss and face its fears. You know, I'm sure your children have at times been afraid of things.
Of course, yeah.
Yep. And
clowns.
Clowns, you know. For me it was bees.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the dark, whatever.
Yeah.
Bullies, you know. And you don't just say, well, yeah, you know, I'm going to ensure that you never have to face that thing for the rest of your life, because you can't guarantee that.
Yeah.
Because they're going to grow up, live their own lives. Someday you're not going to be there. Uh-huh. They have to be. You want them to grow up to be complete, whole adults who can face their fears.
Yeah.
And because I love the church and it is my family, it's not my child. I'm the child.
Okay.
But the church is made up of people. You know, the church is not, you know, one, you know, white bearded guy on a throne. You know, saying, oh, I am the church, you know. Mm. The church is not even the Pope, you know.
Right.
The church is people. And I want the individual people who are afraid of having this conversation to not be afraid of having this conversation, you know, and all of us as a church, I want us to be able to engage in difficult conversations mm-hmm. With trust that truth cannot contradict truth.
Okay.
That if something is true scientifically, factually on the ground, mm-hmm. like the existence of gender incongruence, if it's a case that some people, you know, their brains are wired in different ways from other markers, you know, then acknowledging the fact that that exists cannot possibly be a threat to what is essential and true about our faith.
Okay. That's okay. So two truths are not going to like take each other out, right?
Exactly.
They complement each other. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if this exists in the world, then it exists in the world that God created.
Yeah, okay. Yes.
You know, you're not going to destroy the world by acknowledging that this phenomenon exists in the world. You can't possibly destroy the world mm-hmm. by acknowledging that this exists. You know, it's kind of cliché to go to Galileo, but it's the Galileo problem basically.
Yeah.
You know, our interpretation of scripture leads us to believe that, you know, X is the case. We have this scientific data telling us that that Y might be the case. But Y would contradict X in some ways,
yeah.
not completely. And so because we think X is the fullness or must be correct, we're gonna pretend Y doesn't exist. You know, but X here is an interpretation of A, which is the reality.
Yes, you know? Okay.
Acknowledging that Y exists can't possibly destroy A. Mm-hmm. You may have to change X, your interpretation of A, but that's okay. We change interpretations all the time. You know, right now when we talk about, you know, for example, we talk about the soul being the form of the body. This is language which is Aristotelian in nature, comes from Aquinas and especially from the Council of Vienne in 1312. Is where we get this phrase, you know, the majority of Christianity took place before we had this phrase, the soul, you know, before we used this phrase as saying it was an essential part of church teaching, the soul is the form of the body, you know, 1300 years of Christianity before we say, okay, well, this phrasing is how we're going to say things. Doesn't mean the phrasing is wrong. Mm-hmm. It just means that we successfully followed Jesus for 1300 years before we used that particular phrasing,
yeah.
that our phrasing changes, you know, sometimes... Okay. You know, as our understanding of the human person increases, you know, we've only known, for example, about sex chromosomes for 100 years. You know, before that, you know, person's sex is what they're identified with as birth. If it's ambiguous, you pick one.
Mm.
You may or may not be right, but you just pick one.
Yeah.
Now we look at sex chromosomes if it's ambiguous and say, okay, well, they have XY or XX, so therefore, you know, they're male or female and, you know, can raise them accordingly. Again, their gender identity might not match that, but you're going to be much more likely to get it right if you can look at the chromosomes. So our interpretation of how to identify if someone is male or female changed completely, yeah. you know, 100 years ago.
100 years ago, yeah.
And as we learn more, things are going to continue to change. You know, our understanding of the universe changed. Our understanding of psychology changes, you know, once we're aware of the, you know, more aware of the role of the brain and how it controls certain things. So we just have to be open to understanding that science and faith don't contradict each other.
Yeah, right.
You know, we can engage in scientific inquiry freely without having to be worried that it's somehow going to destroy our faith. And we can live our faith without worrying that, you know, if we live our faith, it doesn't have to damage our ability to do science. You know, and so I think that we just, we need to not be afraid of learning as much as we can. And as long as we trust that, you know, and ask for God's guidance and act out of submission to God and love of God and of neighbor, God, yeah, you know, Jesus promised to lead us into all truth.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, we don't have to be worried about new truths that we discover and how they relate to the rest of the truths. Mm-hmm. You know, it all comes back to Christ as truth.
Yes.
And no acknowledgement that something is true can possibly threaten that.
That's...
So we don't have to be afraid.
Yeah, don't. Yeah, that it seems like I've heard that a couple times in the Bible over my reading of that. You know, you mentioned, so you're in Eastern Kentucky and you're a monk and you're single and you wear the religious clothes and so all these things that are like not what we typically expect, but also in our current religious climate in the United States, I mean, you're a person who loves the church.
Yeah.
Right. That's kind of like not real popular, right? Maybe people go to church, but there's not like a ton of people out there just like, man, I just love the church, right? And you're in the Catholic Church. And so tell us a little bit about, like, I'm curious, like, what makes you love the church, especially as, you know, my feed and internet or on social media is always kind of point. It's not like, did you know the church are the first people who started universities? It's more like, did you know the church is hurting people and starting wars and like, ah, you know, why love the church?
Because the church is the body of Christ. You know, we're all made in God's image. Every person is lovable. Mm. And I believe that the church is the, because it's the body of Christ, it's the institution missioned to preach that, to preach that everybody is made in the image of God and is loved by God. That's our mission. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's been baptized, committed themselves in faith to Christ, is a member of the church. You know, that we have that shared mission. So even though we may disagree on things, even though we may hurt each other at times, we're still all part of the same family. We've been adopted into God's family and given that and taken on that mission. I mean, we're all, every human being is a member of God's family. We're all God's children. But you know, choosing or really being chosen by Christ to join that mission, you know, gives you a responsibility and it also gives you an adopted, you know, son or daughter relationship to God through Christ, mm-hmm. in that shared mission, that family. And that means oftentimes we do have to hold each other accountable as family members.
Right, yeah,
I
yeah. Mean,
I'm not saying, you know, just because you're Christian, you get a free pass. That is obviously not the case.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as a parent, you know, you hold your children to standards.
Yes.
And you hold your brothers and sisters and your friends to standards, mm-hmm. you know. But I love the church because I love Christ. You know, mm-hmm. we're all Christ's body. And it's my family. You know, my identity is rooted in Christ, and therefore my identity is essentially and inextricably connected to all the other members of the church. I mean, I couldn't leave the church if I wanted to. You know,
yeah.
I am a member of Christ's body, and therefore it's my responsibility to care for my brothers and sisters, both inside and out of the church. But especially, I stay in the church, especially in the Catholic Church, because I have hope for the church, because I believe in the church's love of truth and desire to serve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe some people have been called to leave, you know, the Catholic Church specifically,
okay.
to show that you can live Christ in other, you know, in other churches,
okay.
you know. That, you know, there have been times where the Catholic Church, you know, has said, you can't possibly be called to the vocation to which you're called, which they've said to me, which they've said to others that we know, friends yeah. we have in common.
Yeah.
And they, you know, the Catholic Church was not going to allow them to live that vocation, but they felt God calling them to that vocation.
Absolutely.
So they went to the church that recognized that vocation
yeah.
and said, we will allow you to live it. And by their witness in the churches in which they serve, they are showing that people like me can live this vocation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, hopefully the Catholic Church will continue to see that and see, oh, you know, these folks are actually living that vocation pretty well. All these horrible things we thought might happen are not happening. You know, they're actually demonstrating holiness by their witness. And be able to recognize that and go, oh, well, maybe we should reconsider, mm-hmm. you know, what our expectations are. And then there are other people who are called to stay in and say, by their staying, I still have hope for you.
Yes.
You know, I don't give up on you.
Yeah, I'm not giving up on you. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I'm here to call you to your face from within saying, you know, we have to reconsider how we're doing things, and to show that I believe that you still believe in the truth, mm-hmm. and are being led by Christ to the truth. So I think, you know, God works beyond our categories.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so even though our rules might say, well, you know, this is the one true church, and there are, you know, I came from Presbyterianism. I was a Christian before I became a Catholic.
Yes.
You know, which is, I think, one of the gifts I've been grateful to have, to know that you don't have to be Catholic to be a good Christian, you know, and you don't have to be a Christian in order to be a good follower of God. And yeah. You don't have to be a person of religious faith in order to be a person who's trying to serve the truth and love one's neighbor. Yeah. You know, I have plenty of atheist friends who are incredible witnesses and challenge me in how well they live their lives and how much they care for others. You know, God calls us all in so many ways, you know, to know, love, and serve Him, mm-hmm. In each person's situation. And so it's our responsibility to be open to that and honor it wherever we find it in every person's life. And I feel that how God has been speaking to me in my conscience mm-hmm. is stay and show by staying that you have hope for okay. the Catholic Church, and that you love, and also I stay for the Eucharist. I mean, the sacramentality.
Okay.
That's also a core, you know, understanding of mine. That's why I became Catholic in the first place. You know, the okay. sacramental worldview of Catholicism, yeah. the real okay. presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But yeah, I feel convicted to stay and show not only that I've hoped for the Church to continue to grow in its understanding of these issues, and that the Church wants to grow toward mm-hmm. the truth, but also because there are so many other people, you know, trans folks, LGBT folks, other folks, who don't feel they, for various reasons, have a home in the Catholic Church. Mm. And if I left, then they would feel like there are even fewer people who can welcome them in the Catholic Church, but they want to stay Catholic because yeah. that's their home. That's how they grew up, you know. That's where they want to be. And so the more of us who are able to stay and make homes for them here, then they have allies and supporters within their church. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't all be outside because then they won't have anybody supporting yeah. them inside. So, you know, we're all called. We all have to follow our consciences how we believe that God is calling us to witness the gospel.
But that feels like, you know, the word keeps coming to my mind, burden, like a heavy on your shoulders, right? I mean, here you are carrying. I mean, you love the church and you're doing pioneering work and speaking on trans issues and trans rights and trans realities and the intersection of trans realities inside of Christian faith. That kind of feels like that'd be a really heavy burden.
That's a really good point. And thank you for challenging me on that, because that enables me to say that I actually like being Catholic.
Turns out, man, I like it.
Yeah, I love going to Mass. I love the Eucharist. I love the monastic tradition. I love the Liturgy of Hours that I pray. I love the history of Christian contemplative prayer. I did a second BA, which is now an MA, in theology at Oxford. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest gifts I had there was doing a course in Christian spirituality with Sister Benedicta Ward, who translated the Sayings of the Desert Fathers. She did the Penguin Classics version.
Oh my goodness, that's so cool.
Yeah, and yeah. she's an expert in the Desert Fathers. You know, I did studied with her Julian of Norwich, The Cloud of Unknowing, I highly recommend for anyone who's really interested in contemplative the Christian contemplative tradition.
The Cloud of Unknowing. Okay, yep.
Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. Okay. So those are the four. Julian of Norwich also you have to read if you haven't. it'll heal your heart. And she's really, I think, the one who taught me how to pray.
Wow.
You know, I thought before that, I thought I was a good prayer because I prayed every day. I read my Bible every day.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I went on my first Jesuit Ignatian retreat that I saw people who were praying 3 or 4 hours a day in silence. And I went, who does that?
Yeah, right. Like,
who does that?
I've heard about it, but who actually does
that? What could you possibly be praying about for 3 to 4 hours a day, you know? and then you're reading Cloud of Unknowing, which is about sitting in silence with God. It's written for a solitary.
Yeah.
You know, that's who it's for. The author talks about arrow prayers, so just kind of shooting up words or phrases to God. You know, God, Jesus, help, thank you. Something short from the heart. that was built on in the 20th century by various Trappist and other monks as centering prayer, and reintroduced to, you know, the wider public. You know, all these riches of the Christian, you know, when people talk about meditation, they tend to think about more Buddhist meditation, or just, you know, I'm going to sit there and empty my mind of thoughts, kind of have some version of,
you know,
some pop psychology version of Buddhist meditation. But there's so many people, including myself, who have grown up not realizing we have this 2,000 years of Christian contemplative tradition in Christian meditation. And that's been my, I think, most joyful form of prayer is that silent contemplative prayer from the cloud of unknowing, to just sit in front of the Blessed Sacrament with Jesus and just pray, thank you, or God, or Jesus, or help. Just be there and let kind of waves of, you know, when I'm asked by my spiritual director about my prayer, we've talked about how hard I find to verbalize it, because, you know, to me it feels like an ocean against a rock, you know, and it's just that constant movement of like making contact with the rock and then doing this, and you know, Jesus being the rock, but just that constant, but Jesus is also the ocean, you know, sometimes you're the rock, you're surrounded, but it's just that motion of regular contact and rhythm and just being present, and the motions of the heart toward God, you know, and you know, feeling, which, you know, sometimes you feel God's presence and sometimes you don't, as you know, but just, you know, bringing the world to God and experiencing God as the beating heart of love, you know, that love which moves the sun and other stars, which Dante talks about. God is the love which is the beating heart of the world, you know, through his love is holding all the world and each person and being. And I love that when it's going well, it can be extraordinarily consoling. When it seems to be going poorly, it's just as good for me. to not rely on that feeling of, I'm having a good feeling about God, and therefore I must be praying well. Yeah. You know, God will sometimes take that away, which John of the Cross talks about very well. Because you're starting to rely on the feeling as opposed to God, knowing that you're present, even if you're not feeling God. And, you know, Mother Teresa of Calcutta, after she died, this book, Come Be My Light, was, you know, for 50 years, she didn't feel the presence of God in that consoling way. And so if you're, you know, trying to pray and you're realizing it's pretty dry and you're not feeling that, that's normal. You know, now if you're worried about it, talk to your spiritual director, talk to the chaplain, you know, talk to somebody. But, you know, we're going to have periods where it's you feel more or less the presence of God. But I do love that form of prayer. I love praying the office, especially when I get to visit the monastery where I'm an oblate, where I did my formation, and pray with the guys. I love, you know, reading. Michael Casey is a wonderful Trappist monk in Australia. He has beautiful writings about Benedictine spirituality and monastic life. You know, Thomas Merton. Tolkien is my favorite writer, and the Catholic vision that's in Lord of the Rings. I also love C.S. Lewis, who wasn't Catholic, but had a lot of sympathy with a lot of the Catholic tradition. I love Jesus and his life and gospel and teaching of loving unto death, loving others so much that you're in complete and utter solidarity with them, which is something which is incredibly challenging to me, because I like my creature comforts. I like to sit alone in my chair and watch Netflix and have a bowl of popcorn or some ice cream. And, you know, nobody's bothering me. I'm just by myself. But when I'm at my best self, sometimes you need those moments.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
You know, the Desert Fathers talk about, you know, there's a story of a few of them were like playing with a duck or something, and passersby went, you know, what are you doing, monks playing? That's not monastic. You shouldn't be doing that. And the Abba said, you know, take your bow and pull it tight, okay, and keep it tight, okay, keep. But Abba, if I keep doing this, it'll break. Yes, exactly. Sometimes you have to release the bow.
Yeah.
You know, you can't keep it taut all the time. But when I'm at my best, you know, it's feeling, you know, living, practicing the presence of God, as Brother Lawrence says in that wonderful book, and being available to God, listening to God, and being available to my brothers and sisters and friends and family, you know, to just be present with them, which is also, again, why I love the church. Mm-hmm. I love the people in the church.
Yeah.
You know, you, the church I grew up in, you know, my parents, I love the people at my church. You know, they're so welcoming, here at St. Francis of Assisi in Pikeville. You know, sure, I have issues with other, with people in my church and idiotic things that people say and do, as well as I'm sure people have, I know people have trouble with idiotic things I say and do, as well as things I say and do, which I don't think are idiotic, but they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but I'll just tell you one more story of why I love the church. Mm. I have a very, very close friend, and she and I had a falling out several years ago. We disagreed about something that had happened at a place I was working, which affected her. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, it hurt her very much. And she and I didn't talk for about 2 months. Oh. And it was probably the most painful experience I had in my life up to that point.
Sure.
But during those 2 months when we weren't talking, we still kept going to the same church that we were both parishioners
at. Oh, wow. Okay.
And we were both Eucharistic ministers.
Oh.
So we would be assigned to hold the chalice. And so during those Sundays, we were still giving each other communion.
Whoa, powerful, powerful.
Yeah.
Wow.
And after 2 months, we finally sat down and talked it out. We still don't agree on all the details.
Sure.
But we basically both said we love each other enough that we want to have each other in our lives. Mm. So we talked it through. We went, we still don't agree on the facts, but I'm committed to you and you're committed to me and to this friendship and our, and also our love as Christians, you know, that we both said, here's what I think I did wrong. I'm so sorry. Will you forgive me?
Wow.
And for anything that I may have done wrong that I don't think was wrong.
Yeah, right.
You know, but that still hurt you. You know, anything I did that hurt you, I'm sorry for. And here are the things I know I did wrong.
Okay.
That I acknowledge are wrong and I'm sorry for. And we both forgave each other. Mm. And we said, I love you and I want to be in a relationship with you. And so our friendship is strong to this day.
Wow.
And I think that those 2 months of giving each other communion enabled us to get there. Because it was this act of love, act of solidarity, of saying, even though I'm incredibly mad at you right now, you are my brother or sister in Christ, and I'm offering the blood of Christ, you know, Christ-saving blood to you because I want you to live in Christ, and I'm receiving it from you because I see you as Christ as well, offering me your saving blood. You know, we saw Christ in each other. Mm-hmm. And loved and valued Christ in each other and saw that each of us was made in the image of Christ. And we, you know, I don't want to say it's the person disappeared and we just saw Christ.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
But both of us, because we're Christians, our identities are in Christ.
Yes. I think that reminds me of when, you know, Paul says, we're no longer looking at people in a human perspective.
Yeah.
Right? It's
yeah.
very different. It's, yeah. I mean, you're being informed by this, and you're being immersed in this sacramental view of the world.
Yeah.
Right? And I have to see my friend and all that. And so this powerful encounter that, really is birthed out of, you know, contemplation, sitting with, giving yourself to spiritual discipline. You talked about a spiritual director and... and one of the things I've really taken from our time together already is the idea that the spiritual life takes dedication. I mean, you're dedicating your life to it, but things that matter, you give yourself to, and you invest in and read books, and you quoted all these books and everything. And so as you think about your own journey, and currently in this season, you have a very, almost like a prophetic season of your life. You're asking questions, you're being willing to be kind of a face for some things. Clearly not the only person in the Catholic Church because, you know, it's 2 billion strong or whatever. But so as you do this, how has your spiritual practice helped your, in this prophetic season?
uh, it's an ongoing challenge, but I think it's definitely an ongoing challenge to limit the amount of news headlines and Twitter when.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's first thing. You got to get down on that. I'm still working on that. Because I also want to pray for the things and know what I need to call my congressman about.
Who to call.
Exactly. But I think especially, you know, we're in Lent right now. The main spiritual practice I've added in for Lent was, you know, I was always doing at least a half hour of silent prayer every day.
Okay.
You know, generally in the morning.
Yeah.
But I would, you know, get up, take a shower, pray the office, you know, then sit down. Now I'm doing that first thing.
Oh, okay.
Roll out of bed, go to the chapel.
Okay.
That's first. Before anything else goes into my head, is that quiet time with God. And that has been extremely helpful. Mm. Not only because it's, you know, putting God first, but it's saying I want to fill up the space, you know, that as soon as I wake up, you know, any fears or worries immediately start to rush in.
Okay.
And I'm saying, stop. I'm going to go put God in there first. So that my head and my heart are filled with God, so you don't have enough space to rush in and fill that space.
Yeah.
And so that's been one. It's also just been helpful to, like, I'm reading a biography of Martin Luther King Jr. right now.
Oh, cool.
You know, I try and read each day a story of one of the saints of the day, or you know, Robert Ellsberg has these wonderful
you know, great stuff
collection of people who are not necessarily canonized saints, but are, you know, figures that are inspirational. Had the anniversary of the death of Bonhoeffer yesterday.
So worthy of, like you say, worthy of emulation.
Exactly. And people, it also gives you hope to see other people have faced tough times before and found a way to face them in a variety of different ways. But they found the courage and the hope and the love to say, I got to do something about it. And here's what I did. Here is my meager effort, whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, and so that gives you hope. And it gives me hope also to, like, I went to a friend's wedding this past weekend, you know, and that was just a wonderful witness.
Sure.
To see two people committing to love, you know, each other. And so I'm trying to be deliberate about filling as much as the space that I have reserved for, like, consuming content, like the spiritual reading each day or the reading I do before I go to bed, you know, or even the stuff I watch, you know, because I'm an actor. I love movies and TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know? I try not to watch, I don't watch, you know, trashy reality TV or, like, you know, there is some reality TV, which is good, not very much, but I don't want to, you know, pan the whole genre, but like, we kind of know this stuff that we can watch where it's like, this is not good for me.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, I try and minimize that. But, you know, like, you know, Of Gods and Men, you know, or, you know, the you know, various films about people who are challenging the, you know, Selma.
Yeah.
You know, one way, I watch that every year on MLK Day. You know, stories that give me hope and show humanity at its best, and people trying to follow God and their understanding of what is right and true and good to the best of their ability, that inspires me and gives me hope and helps me feel like I'm part of a wider human community of people who are trying to serve the good. And so that has been very helpful to try and, you know, I do have time each day where I check the headlines so I know what to pray about.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so I know what to call my, you know, representatives about. But I'm actively trying to minimize the time spent with headlines and maximize the time spent with stories of witnesses that have stood the test of time.
Yes.
You know,
well, I think that's, I mean, you know, to kind of push against the isolation that so often when you are standing up for a cause or a group of people or even putting yourself out there, that, like, that automatically isolates.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, you're the problem, or you're the, you know, and then it's like, here you are putting yourself inside the communion of, you know, the witness of the saints, communion of the saints, and it's like, okay, I'm really not alone. I mean, maybe today I am, but, like, I've got Bonhoeffer and King and all these other people who are with me, you know, Oscar Romero and all this, so... You know, so much of your life really is countercultural, right? You know, commitment to pray, make God first. Obviously, you're leading in the trans issues and rights. But one other, oh, there's so many things I want to talk about, right? And I really want to talk about you as a creative also. Yeah. But I am curious. One thing, it's not on our question list, but we'll be spontaneous. why I have a monk in here. Another part of your life is, you know, you're committed to singleness.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which, again, is a kind of a, like, you don't meet a ton of people. You know, you might meet some people who are single just by life circumstance or whatever. But, like, people who commit to that, right? I mean, anything you want to share about like that? Like,
yeah, we were just talking. I'm doing a spiritual director training program right now through St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota.
Cool, yeah.
And as part of that, I'm taking a class on Christian sexual ethics.
Oh, okay.
And we've just been talking about, you know, the difference between voluntary celibacy versus involuntary celibacy.
Okay.
I mean, the most extreme end of that is, it would be like the incel culture.
Oh, yeah, yeah, gotcha. Okay.
Which we were just talking about a bit, and there's, you know, I'm in the midst of watching Adolescence on Netflix about, basically about that, you know, a young man who feels caught up in that. but there's also, you know, what we've more been talking about is, you know, trans people right now in the Catholic Church are not allowed to get married. Mm. There's an instruction from the Vatican from 25 years ago saying trans people cannot get married.
Okay.
You know, people who are lesbian or gay are told they can't get married. Mm. There are other people who, for various, you know, medical reasons, you know, because they can't consummate the marriage act, are kept from getting married, or for various other impediments. And I've been blessed to experience a positive vocation to celibacy.
Okay.
You know, I didn't become a monk because I couldn't get married, and so I settled for this. You know, I actively wanted to become a monk,
yeah.
You know. Even if I could get married, I'd still become a monk. But there's definitely a difference between feeling like this is how you love God and love your neighbor best, versus feeling like, you know, I love God and love my neighbor best through a committed relationship through which I witness that self-giving, you know, I love somebody and they love me, and through our mutual commitment, you know, we witness to God's love and fidelity. I think it's in C.S. Lewis's Arthurian Torso, which is his commentary on his friend Charles Williams' Arthurian poetry.
Oh, wow.
Which, yeah, it's like very rare, very hard to find.
I was going to say, like, never even heard of that.
Yeah. It's worth reading. actually, partly how I became Catholic, through reading this poetry.
Okay.
Yeah. But Charles Williams didn't get to finish his 3 volumes of Arthurian poetry because he died of a heart attack in 1945. But Lewis wrote a commentary on his friend's poetry. And I think it's in there. There's a poem, like Song of the Unicorn or something. Basically, at some point, Lewis talks about how he thinks a lot of artists have a vocation to celibacy, or should, because they devote so much of themselves to their art that there's not a lot left over for their family.
Ah, wow.
Which I'm sure a number of partners of artists can probably attest to.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking.
Some people are better than others, but yeah, there's certainly that issue. And he talks about, you know, the person called to celibacy as... I've been trying to remember the exact words, but it's something like the handmaid or the priest. He talks about the priest as basically the midwife to nuptials that are not his own.
Hmm.
You know, this person who assists new life, the new life of the couple, and by extension their family, into being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, assists new life through baptism, which you do as a priest. Mm-hmm. You know, that. The person called to celibacy is assisting and bring in their neighbor and bringing new life to birth. Mm. And I actually think, like in Harry Potter should have not gotten married at the end, because I feel like that's very much like his call was like helping his neighbor, you know, and helping Ron and Hermione come together. But it always felt weird that he like had this relationship slapped in. I really think he was called to celibacy. But anyway,
that's a hot take.
Yeah, it is a hot take. The way I feel called to love is, I love accompanying my brothers and sisters and being the person who they know they can call at any time, and witnessing to their love and helping, you know, helping bring joy to their lives, and intercessing, you know, before God for them. But I've never felt called to marriage.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, it just never was something that was an important priority in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I know other friends, you know, who don't feel called to marriage either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, But for me, it really was, when I discovered religious life, I went, this is what I've been looking for my entire life, a way to offer myself completely to God, to be at the complete service of my brother and sister. Without having a commitment to a family. Whereas I feel like, based on my friendship with those who are married, you know, and my own parents' relationship, mm-hmm. That my friends who feel called to marriage, you know, they don't have any less of a desire to serve God and to be a loving witness to God. But the way they feel called to do that is by loving a concrete person.
Right.
And letting that love bear fruit, you know, through raising children, through raising family. And that is how they witness to God's love. And then through their families, they make their families homes of hospitality and, you know, fountains of love for the community through their family life, through their married life. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, it was through that availability and singleness that I feel called to, you know, to create a fountain of love that bears fruit, and how I can support and, you know, be, you know, midwife to nuptials, not my own, to help and support, you know, my neighbor. So I think it really is just how one is made and how one feels called to love and be in relationship with God and with one's neighbor. And for me, when I realized, because, you know, that wasn't really a thing in the Presbyterian church growing up, you know, everybody gets married.
Of course.
You know,
that's expectation.
But once I realized that was a legitimate vocational call, I went, that's the thing I've been looking for. You know, that's how I feel I'm most free to love and most myself to love, you know. And it comes with its own loneliness, but sure. I'm sure, you know, just because you're married doesn't mean you never feel lonely.
Absolutely.
You know, we all have our forms of loneliness that we have to deal with. But, you know, Jesus talks about, you know, if you give up, you know, husbands, wives, spouses, you know, parents, children, lands, you know, you get them back 100-fold. Mm-hmm. And one gift of being in religious life is, you know, you don't have a family of your own, but you get, you know, a family 100-fold, and, you know, I can go to any religious house and feel at home that I'm with, you know, fellow, you know, male and female religious who share the same sense of commitment, the same sense of vocation.
Yeah, that's a powerful insight.
And I'm welcomed into people's, you know, family homes and their lives in a supportive way, but in a way that's never competitive. So nobody's worried that I'm, like, out to steal their spouse or, you know, I have good, close female friends, but they're not worried that I'm, like, secretly trying to, you know, come on to them. You know, it places me in position of being, you know, especially for some of my female friends who have had not so good experiences with men.
Yeah.
It puts me in a place where I'm safe, you know, and they know that I don't have an ulterior agenda, you know, and I can just be a friend, you know, and help support them in whatever way they need. And I'm already committed. I'm off the market.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, you're safe.
I mean, yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I'm just stunned by the creative call of your life and the way that you are creatively expressing this in kind of in a surprising pocket, Eastern Kentucky, and here you are, you know, and pursuing truth but really giving yourself to, I think the thing that really stands out is just, like, depth, right? I mean, we were talking earlier of people, whoever they are, for resistance to conversation. It's like, well, you're missing depth. Mm. And, you know, and people who maybe aren't want to give themselves to the church or give themselves to spirituality, they might be missing a kind of a depth, maybe, right? A depth of what maybe, and I'm not critiquing people, but it's like there's a depth to all these things, these mysteries of life, and you're willing to ponder deeply these realities, and you keep pushing and keep asking and keep exploring, and as discoveries are made, then you say, oh, that's what I've been looking for. It seems like you've, you know, multiple times in your life, it's like, yeah, that's what I've been, that's it, okay, there it is, you know. So I just really admire your witness and in all of your love for Jesus and the way that it's clearly evident in your life and who you are. So I appreciate you taking your time to hang out with us today.
Thank you. It's always a lot of fun to hang out with you, Rob.
Ah, great.
Father Rob now, I get to say.
Right.
Yeah.
When I simply don't know.